ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We've always been very bad at predicting the future. Don't believe me? Well, 67 years ago, the ABC asked Australians to do just that, and...
You all commute daily and hourly so fast through space in your private flying saucers...
Global peace and international harmony will be completely attained by the year 2000.
Yeah, still waiting on that world peace. I'm Matt Bevan, and from If You're Listening, this is Black Swans, a series about the events we can't see coming, no matter how hard we try. It's available now on ABC Listen.
Karen Little represents a lot of firsts. The Arrernte woman is the first Indigenous senator for South Australia, the first Indigenous woman to win a parliamentary seat in the state, and maybe one of the first, or certainly one of only a few federal parliamentarians to have previously worked as a Jillaroo. It's been a turbulent year for the Liberal Party after its punishing election loss in May 2025. So how does someone like the senator for South Australia navigate through that noise? Through a life of journalism, tourism, leadership roles with housing trusts and universities, why did she choose a political life? And why did she choose the Liberal Party? How does she view herself in the party's rebuild? In the final sitting week of 2025, I sat down with the senator to talk on a range of topics and to hear more about the person behind the politics. And just a really important note to acknowledge, this was recorded before the devastating events in Bondi that targeted Jewish Australians on December the 14th. Welcome to Politics Now, the interview, Karen Little.
Hello, great to join you.
Who is Karen Little?
Well, Karen Little is a person that entered politics very late in life, and I entered it late, I think, with a cacophony of experiences that I think are very useful in this place. It means that when issues come up, I know a little bit about a lot of things and enough to know when I need to ask more questions about them before I form a decision or contribute to an outcome. And I think even though I came to this very late, I think it gives me a really different perspective on many things.
And your own background is such an intriguing, different, diverse story. You are Indigenous. You've worked in business. You've worked here at the ABC, Karen. You really have done a lot of these things. You have kids. Talk to me about the way you think about all of those different identities together.
Well, it's true. It's hard to describe who I am, but that's how I tend to look at life, is I don't put people into a box and decide that they must all be the same. I think diversity of views is important, and people's right to express that and for me to challenge that is also critical. So all of those things lumped together, I think, informs how I deal with things every day, how I work with people. You know, in my early life as a journalist, I didn't think twice about doing things that other people might have thought was a bit unusual. I remember interviewing National Action. And in the very, very early days, going out and having to interview Pauline Hanson. And for me, that was not like interviewing anyone else. It was just ask the questions that you would ask everyone else and be prepared to challenge as well as respect the responses that come back to me. So it's kind of how I've really gone through life. And those very early days, particularly at the ABC, when, you know, you had all sorts of eclectic things that you might be covering. And as a young journalist, threw myself into everything, including when I went to commercial television, where the coverage was a little different, my responsibilities were a little different, but you just got on with it. I had the absolute privilege of having an incredible mother and father, and, you know, there was no gender requirement for any of the things that we needed to do. My dad would say things like, I don't care you're a woman or a girl, we might have to find a slightly different way of doing it, but you're going to do it. Mm-hmm. You're just going to do it.
Your parents, your family, the Little family, is kind of a very famous Aboriginal family in the Northern Territory in South Australia. Just tell me about your parents. It's a beautiful story.
Well, our story goes back a few generations before my parents. The Scottish side of my family, and I don't pretend for any minute that I'm Scottish, because my entire identity has been an Indigenous and Aboriginal identity, an identity that actually is an Arrernte identity. That's the language of both of my parents. That's the cultural group of both my parents. So I see myself as Arrernte first. They they started an early career pioneering Central Australia, the tourism industry, the pastoral industry. And my great-great-grandfather provided a space for people to even sell and trade to the tourists in the early days. And so he built an economy around Aboriginal people there. There were hundreds of people that lived on their pastoral property seeking sanctuary, not just from the missions and not just from the pastoral industry and some of the toughness out there at the time of drought, but also really benefiting from the economy that existed and being entrepreneurial about that.
Your family weren't sort of involved in the Aboriginal like rights movement per se, were they? It was kind of a different involvement in Aboriginal affairs.
Oh yeah, I think that's probably not a correct reflection. We don't. My grandmother was a very strong proponent of not having the dam in Alice Springs many, many decades ago. They were very strong on people appreciating our right to country and culture. But they also didn't expect to get that from someone else. That was a right they asserted themselves by growing us kids up on country, by making sure that we knew the stories, by making sure we respected elders in the proper, respectful way, but that we also made sure that we were proud of having a voice of our own. So, you know, they didn't seek to have that validated by somebody else. That was their responsibility to validate it, and they did. And it was asserted in that way.
A couple of years ago, your father took on the police and challenged the police for discrimination. Just tell me about that story and the impact it had, because you were already in Parliament.
Yes. Well, you know, my parents are always people of principle. And when he saw that he wasn't being treated in the way that he thought people should be treated, you know, he asked questions. He demanded an investigation into what how he was treated, and he wasn't going to give up on that, even though it was a pretty tough time for him. He asserted what he believed were his rights and pushed it through until he was satisfied.
Was he talking to you at the time?
Well, I knew what was going on, but it was more about supporting him to do what he thought was right. That was the most important thing about that whole process.
You mention all the things you've done before, and you really have. So then why politics?
Well, I kind of always thought I'd be interested in politics, but I wasn't sure that I could ever get there. It is an incredible privilege to come into this space. Did I think that I had everything in my toolkit that I could contribute in a really responsible, respectful way? Yes. But the opportunities are actually small. Sometimes there's a bit of luck. Sometimes you have to do work over many years. I think what I was pretty clear about was when I was deciding to come into politics, you know, I'd raise my children. I'd even help raise other people's children in my home for many years. But it was time for me to actually take all of those things and not feel myself compromised, and I could just get on with this job. You know, I was just sharing with you the hell of a few days I've had just before coming in here. You know, my family is still wrapped up in all of that, but I felt confident in getting on that plane and getting over here and feeling like I could give 100% to here, and that was important for me. So I delayed it.
Is that because of the... Tell me about that family and the way that kind of everyone rallies around you.
Well, you know, I had a sister who just happened to be stuck in Adelaide because she was on her way to Darwin and the flights were cancelled. She's a very busy, busy woman.
And very high-profile woman.
Very high-profile woman. And I said, how's it going in Darwin? And she said, well, I'm in Adelaide. And I said, well, I have to bury my dog this afternoon. And she went, I'll be there. Give me 10 minutes. It was raining. It was terrible. We were both shovels in hand. But we got the job done. And that's what our families do. And that's what all families should do.
Powerful relationship you have with your siblings, right?
Yeah, it's challenging sometimes. And it's also powerful when you come from places and experiences that we have. You have a very strong voice. My husband would always say, when you guys get around the table, it's certainly not a quiet, polite conversation. But we all have our say, and we all feel like that we've had our say. And we don't move. We don't walk out. we just fight it out. And so I think that's really important.
Because there's political diversity and views in your family
there's
too, right?
There's kind of political diversities, but in the end we respect that diversity too. And we have to be really careful that we're not attacking the individual, that we're actually talking about the issue. And I think sometimes that gets forgotten.
If you weren't a politician, what would you be?
I would be fiercely independent. In terms of my how I get my income from, the decisions I would make that would support that. I don't know. I think I could do anything. I'd be looking out for any opportunity to contribute in what I saw as a meaningful way. Before I came into Parliament, I'd done a bit of work with Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement, putting in place their custody notification scheme. You know, they told me that they'd had a couple of years trying to get that, and I said I've got 12 weeks, and we delivered that. It was a great program, could be better, but I thought that was a really important thing to get done before I came in here.
When I think of you, and this is my own from knowing you, I don't think that you operate on a sort of left-right dichotomy on Aboriginal rights, that it's just this way and it's a hardline way, or it's sort of a way which is just about money and investment. These are tropes, but yeah, that you kind of sit somewhere in the middle. Am I right?
Well, it's kind of a reflection on how I got into this place. If you ask a political purist, they would say, I got here with the vote in pre-selection with the votes of the moderates and the right. That is true. I think when you provide the evidence to people, you put up a compelling argument, you respectfully communicate what you believe, you can get people over the line. And I think my pathway into politics reflects that, and also reflects how you've just described how you see me.
What's your red line, a principle you hold that you never compromise on?
It is the safety of individuals. It's the safety of individuals, not just to be safe from physical harm, but to also be safe from mental harm, because those things have far-reaching consequences and we don't always know the impact. So it is about, really recognising and following through on what I say I'm going to do. That they're the kinds of principles that I work by. I don't even actually think about it very often, but that's how I get things done.
And it's fair to say that the Liberal Party at the moment is in a moment of sort of existential working out its direction. What role are you playing internally, as much as you can share, in terms of that future direction with all of that lived experience you've described?
Well, my role in all that is we have made a decision about our leadership. I respect that decision that's been made, and I'll continue to do that. I guess the fundamental principle is I will focus on the things and the responsibilities that I have been given, and that is to prosecute in the area of social services and Indigenous Australians, and I will remain unwavering from that. That's my job now, and to convince people and MPs that they might have to look at things differently. You know, people think in this space that it's all about the combat on the floor of Parliament or in the media. But there are sometimes too conversations that we have directly with other members of Parliament on the other side about our positions, about information. And I think if you are a politician, you are better for it when you have an open door for communication for information. You're still the ultimate decision maker, and I or others may not be happy with that, but at least the door is open.
Did you sometimes find that under the last regime, under Peter Dutton, that time, some of the rhetoric that was used was too hardline about Aboriginal people or Aboriginal affairs?
Well, Peter's door was always open to me. He always sought my views on issues. And I think we've got some really tough conversations that need to be had. People don't like to have those conversations. I won't shy away from having those conversations. And sometimes people will try and shut down debate to try and ensure that you don't keep picking away and asking questions of them. They try and deflect responsibility for their accountability to provide answers or to question themselves. So, I think the issues are important. How we speak about them might be a little bit different, but that's reflecting too and respectful of the diversity of people that are in this place, you know.
What's more important, to be influential or visible?
Well, I think both of those things are important to me, because I don't think you can be relevant if people don't know who you are, don't know what you stand for, don't kind of listen as soon as you open your mouth. I mean, I coming from a television background as well, you know, I sort of say to people, Well, yeah, they're talking, but nobody's listening. So you have to have, you know, there's sometimes it's a natural talent where you have presence. Some people have it, some people have to work at it. And I think that's a really important thing too. But it's really to be there. To be there, to be accessible is what's important to me.
Is there anything personally or professionally that you regret?
I regret the terrible way that this country went to the Voice to Parliament and the referendum.
That it is unfortunate that we are looking at this from a win-lose proposition. Nobody wins from this referendum being conducted in this way. The world won't end after this referendum. The work will continue, regardless of the result, to improve the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
I hope I don't ever see that again in my lifetime. And I'm not taking sides on that, but what I am saying is that it has had a detrimental effect, I think, on the whole country, including Aboriginal Australians, and particularly for those people who are in remote areas who weren't really engaged in the conversation. I think sometimes their isolation and their poverty means that they're excluded from real participation. And I'm talking about authentic, genuine participation in matters. And those things I think are important to recognise and appreciate. They're not always the same as people in the city, as people in a metropolitan regional area. That's not to say the issues of poverty aren't the same, but the access to things that might ameliorate them might be a little different.
You say I'm not going to take sides. Do you mean, because you obviously advocated for a no vote and strongly held that view, but do you mean you can see responsibility on both sides of how that got so ugly?
Absolutely. I can see responsibility on both sides. But then, you know, it's not so binary as there was a no side that was the no side, the same as there was a yes side that was the yes side. So I think when you were close enough, you know, you can't take the view of some groups that put out pamphlets on both sides, which, you know, I remember going on polling day and seeing that sign that said, I think it was 83% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people say yes to this. Well, that just simply wasn't true. And it wasn't true on polling day. So, you know, I get frustrated when people politicise something like that. When I knew it to be true, I knew it to be true before it really got underway. I know it to be true now. It's really sad for me when I have people who still come up to me today and say things like, I voted no, these are Aboriginal people, but I didn't tell anybody. The price was too high, and that was a terrible thing to impose on people, and I think we could have done it differently.
And from the no sides perspective, because we're not taking sides, we're critiquing, following this conversation, what did they do that you think was too divisive?
Well, I think there were a couple of pamphlets out there that I'd heard were out there. I didn't see them myself. I think, you know, they weren't certainly put out by the Liberal Party, but they were put out by people who had a no position. So they were reflected in the media that was the no side. Well, the world is more complicated than that. And I think all of those things kind of fed into what was a bad experience for both sides.
Think it led to more racism against Aboriginal people?
Well, I think it led to truth-telling that was avoided in that whole process. I mean, I had the absolute privilege. I've told you that I held a no position before I came into Parliament. So I was absolutely privileged to sit on the committee that actually looked at the words. And I think this turned into a right side of history, wrong side of history, yes and no. But in actual fact, you really needed to dig down in what are the implications of what we're being asked. And if you ask most people about, well, what were the three paragraphs that actually informed what was going to make a difference in the implementation? Because let's face it, whether it's good policy or bad policy, the real effect is in the implementation. And that's what I was looking at as part of that committee, which cemented my view. It is true that there are people who will be eternally harmed on both sides by that. But I do think, and I do get frustrated when people continue to make everything we do going forward about that. We've got to stop continually going to the past. I get frustrated in this place where I hear people talking about the negative narrative almost reinforcing in a perverse way the stereotype about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. You know, we've got people who are, you know, involved in the space race. We've got people who are involved in aerospace. We've got people who are just out there doing ordinary things. But we've also got people who are still living on slabs in the middle of a town that gets lots and lots of money for addressing those issues. So, you know, we have to respect the diversity of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and make sure that our focus is always on those people that will find it hardest to make their way in life. But also I get frustrated because, you know, a couple of generations ago, you know, you go out to Murujuli and I take people out there to see family and, you know, there are pintucks in those cyclone bed mattresses because those older people worked in the industry, in the hospitality industry. They worked in the pastoral industry. And when I was working at Voyages, you know, I made a huge effort to move from one person employed from the local community to nearly 20 in the 18 months I was there. And they weren't treated differently, but how I needed to respond to some of the challenges of language, of health, of housing, of their ability to manage fight and flight, had to be responsive, not a one size fits all. And for me, it was critical that they were working in an environment where they were treated the same as everyone else, and the expectations were exactly the same.
You are very proud of your Aboriginal heritage, as you should be. But I found, and I want to go back to it, at the start, you made a really distinctive point that you're Aranda and you don't really identify with your Scottish side so much, and clearly it's part of your history. But I found that really fascinating, the way people think about themselves and their culture. Why is that such a big part of the way you think of yourself?
Well, I always think of myself, and I always have, even in the times when I was in the media, you know, I'd say to not just people I worked with then, but I say it to my colleagues now, I am just me. And I said that in my first speech, me first. I'm in charge of my identity. I'm in charge of what I do. You can leave all that to me. And I think that that's my identity informs how I might look at things, how I might respond to things. But my actual identity is mine, not yours. I don't need your help. Thank you very much. And it takes me back to The Voice when I remember standing there in a polling booth and somebody just came out from nowhere. There was clearly a person who was a very emotional, committed no voter who was having a crack at somebody. And I was having a chat to this guy going, no, you can't be doing it that way. You know, let's find a different way of doing this. And some woman came out of nowhere saying how offended she was about what he'd said. And I said, I don't need you to be offended on my behalf. Thank you very much. I need him to understand that I'm unhappy with what he said, but that he learns from that and he learns in front of me and I don't ostracize him because of that. Please don't be offended on my part and think that that you need to do that, because that's about that person feeling good about what they've done. It does nothing to actually improve the situation. So I think, you know, I say to my colleagues, sometimes I'm going to stand in front of you, sometimes behind you, sometimes to the side of you, and that's exactly how it should be. There's this wrong that happens in this country where it's like Aboriginal people have to always, and I use Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people together collectively, have to be the people that actually are always in front on these issues. That's not true. We need people to sometimes stand in front of us, beside us, and behind us in equal measure and at appropriate times, and that's how we get stuff done. We can't be continually identifying ourselves as something different, something so special. I say to people often in more casual settings that, you know, when you treat people like a threatened species and don't have the same expectations, they will be. And I say that too because I've done some work with threatened species. And you have to be absolutely aggressive about ensuring that they have everything that they need to balance the fairness and to give people an opportunity.
What's the hardest thing you've ever done?
Oh, wow. The hardest thing I've ever done is probably stand by and watch my parents fight for justice when my sister was killed. That has an extraordinary effect on not just individuals, but families and communities.
And for those who don't know that story, and I know it's a difficult story, but just for our listeners, your sister was killed by a partner in a domestic violence situation.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, the hardest thing to do, and I guess it's the same for everyone, is to watch someone you love suffer. You know, those things are tough. Fighting for justice. My parents fought for justice for her all the way to refusing an appeal to the High Court. It was the right thing to do. It didn't change the circumstances, but I remember my mother saying, you know, what's really important here is the principal. You know, she deserves some form of justice. We can't have people thinking that it's just another life. And because she is no longer with us, she doesn't have rights. And my mother asserting her rights with her, my family every single day, going to court, listening through the evidence. While that was all happening, it was enduring, it was long, it was painful. You know, that was the hardest thing. And I wasn't even doing that. I was watching that.
But you were her sister.
Yeah, yeah.
So you carry that. Yeah. That's the heaviest
Everyone
thing you carry,
that.
Isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yeah, it is. It is.
And every day in Parliament, kind of, I imagine, sort of, it's kind of something that you think about and you live with.
Well, I think you go back to, so what if? And you think about how might this have an effect on that person. And that's why I'm pretty specific about, you know, when it's about talking around domestic violence or it's talking around a service delivery, it's talking about governance. I want optimum service delivery to the most vulnerable people, because when that doesn't happen, there actually is a victim. Mm-hmm. And the victim is that person that was hoping they would get that service. The service is caught up into a governance turmoil, so they don't get the service they intended, or they don't get the service that you would expect or that I would expect. To me, that's not good enough. We have to have the same expectations regardless of where that service is delivered. Whether it's mainstream service or an Aboriginal community-controlled service, the expectation must be the same, because when you really talk about human rights, you're talking about that person seeking that service having access to the best possible service delivered by the best possible practitioners. And that's why we live in this great country that we live in, because we can continue to argue and pursue those. They're not ideals, they're essentials.
What do you want your political epitaph to say?
Well, that'll be for others to say.
I'm letting you write
it,
Karen.
It's probably one of those things that I find it really difficult to talk about myself. Yeah.
But you have such an interesting story to share, right?
I think when people talk about me, I'm actually surprised, because they say, you know, you have a warmth about you. You have an appreciation of people in all of their circumstances. You know, I'm not sure what they would say. I think they would say that I was always open to arguments. I didn't insert myself into an argument just for the point of having the argument. The pursuit was always improving outcomes, and that's what keeps me focused. That keeps me getting out of bed every day, and always line of sight on the people that matter to me. It's not just Indigenous Australians, it's women, it's, you know, South Australians that live out in a regional area, a remote area. You know, you can't forget the little things and the big things, and you have to be selfish about giving yourself to all of those things.
You did something which is pretty extraordinary, which is to raise foster children when you actually, you know, had your own children. Why did you do that?
Well, I've got to give credit where it's due. It was really my husband that allowed that to happen, where, you know, both occasions I just kind of walked out into the yard and said, oh, by the way, and he went, yeah, okay. You know, it's about surrounding yourself by others that let you do things. It's.
But why did you want to do it?
Well, it was the right thing to do. That was essentially just it. I had a home, I had an income that allowed me to just do a lot of things, and that's the thing about poverty, right, when you've got opportunity, you can make decisions, but then you've got wealthy people who don't necessarily make those decisions either. I did it because I was prepared to do something that I really had no idea what I was doing, but I knew that I just had to do it. I didn't do it alone though. I did it with other people who created an environment for those children to flourish. And so it certainly wasn't something I did on my own. There was a lot of people that helped along the way.
What did it give you?
It reinforced for me in this place that low expectations is not the way for people. It reinforced that when you provide a safe home and a safe place for people, they flourish. And it is true in those cases. I used to joke and say, you know what, can I give my kids up instead? Can I give them up? My kids still laugh at that. They're always laughing at me. They keep me grounded. You know, it was great to see and experience and be part of that, you know, you create opportunity for others and we all flourish from that. We all benefit from that.
Karen Little, thank you so much for joining us on Politics Now, the interview.
Thank you. It was terrific to join you and your listeners.
That's it for this episode of Politics Now's special summer series, The Interview. All summer, we'll be bringing you the people behind the politics. So follow Politics Now on the ABC Listen app so you never miss an episode.